Well, as it turns out, looks like you're going to get a lot of me this weekend, and I'm apologizing in advance for that. Last night was fun. Nicholas Meyer, the director of Star Trek II and Star Trek VI, and wrote good parts of other Star Trek movies that I'm sure you've enjoyed over the years, as well as The Day After, the famous made-for-television movie, still holds the record for the most viewers for any television movie ever. 100 million people watched that movie that night. On last night, then we did some open lines, which I'll get back to coming up when we do a little crypto news here in just a second. And then tonight, it's The Poisoner's Handbook, Deborah Blum, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. It's very, I mean, we think we live in odd times. We think that our society has turned brutal in a way that it had never been like before. Wait till you hear some of the murder statistics from the Jazz Age, more specifically, the poisoning statistics, and how many people were poisoning other people just for laughs, it would seem. Serial killers abounded back in the Jazz Age because poison was such an easy thing to get away with. Not so now, obviously, and we'll talk more about that coming up next hour. But it was not just a dark period in terms of the poisons that people were intentionally putting in food and drink, but also because of the amount of poisons that were in the atmosphere. We'll talk a little bit about the poisons we're living with today, too, coming up. And we'll do some open lines this hour. We may even pick up on a couple of conversations we started last night. And then we'll talk with Mark Lerner. You know Mark, he's been with on us several occasions. He's a professional astrologer. I think we last had him on with the prediction show back on January 1st. I don't know if he's been on since then, but he's going to talk a little bit about the earthquake, which we were on last night, both as it happened and then as the story was developing about the tsunami, which fortunately didn't turn out to be anything today, or well, anything much anyway. I know that there were a couple of people who were affected by the tsunami, a couple of people killed initially, but beyond that, were okay. And then coming up tomorrow night, as it turns out, you're gonna have to put up with me for one more night, as George Knapp is having some technical problems. So he'll be back tomorrow night, but I'll tell you more about that later on. First, some crypto news, and then Mark Lerner, before we get to open lines at the bottom of this hour on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. Before I get started, let me give a shout out to a couple of people on Coast to Coast. Phyllis, I hope you liked the little card we sent you in the mail, and thank you for listening not far from here. Kirby and Jay and Jill and John and other people that have been Facebooking. I guess that's what is that what you call it? I don't, booking face? I don't know. One of the two. And then for all the people who are signed up, I'll get to you tonight. I look forward to friending about another 200 or so people who are waiting. That'll bring me pretty close to 3,000. Coasty Christ sent me a link to a PDF file called Playing Chicken, Avoiding Arsenic in Your Meat. You can Google that. She was right. It is relevant to tonight's conversation about the Poisoner's Handbook, and we'll get to that coming up next hour. She hasn't friended me yet on Facebook, but she might after the crowd clears, she said. I'm almost at 3,000. I only get 5,000, I'm told, so don't wait too long. Chris also asked, you've probably seen the Ian Punnett equals DB Cooper website out there by now, that page on Facebook. I haven't, but I've heard there's an Ian Punnett is DB Cooper page out there. Very funny. I'm super good with it. As long as people are calling me DB in relation to Cooper, I'm laughing. Marty in San Diego sent me a story from Canada about a guest we had a few weeks ago, Charles Pellegrino, the author of The Last Train from Hiroshima. Very powerful, fascinating, fresh book, but he's had to issue a retraction on something actually talked about on this show. I'll read you a little bit here from this article, and I'll link it up on my blog here in a second. The publisher of a disputed book about the atomic bombing of Japan has confirmed that a key source misrepresented himself and promised that any errors would be fixed soon. Charles Pellegrino told the New York Times last week that he was likely duped by Joseph Fuoco, who claimed to have flown on one of the planes accompanying the Enola Gay, the B-29 bomber that dropped the world's first nuclear bomb. But surviving members of the crew of the plane, known as Necessary Evil, whose role was to photograph the nuclear explosion, said that Fuoco was not on the mission, and scientists and historians also doubted him. Fuoco, who died in 2008, had said he was a last-minute replacement for flight engineer James R. Corliss. The family of Corliss, who died in 1999, had produced evidence that he was, in fact, on the plane. And Pellegrino, to his credit, in a statement issued earlier this week, said that since learning of his error, his, quote, only concern has been to get history right. In other words, to make sure that flight engineer James R. Corliss takes his rightful seat on that plane. They're going to fix future editions of Last Train to Hiroshima. That having been said, it's still a great book. Last night, a caller during open lines remarked that he thought all of this snow that we've been getting up and down the East Coast, et cetera, was God's way of pointing out how ridiculous the claims of global warming are. But he also seemed to bark at the article that I said that actually said January was one of the warmest Januaries on record. A couple of people wrote emails telling me how cold and snowy things were in their particular part of the world. And while that's fair anecdotally, the scientific averages tell a different story, according to NOAA. The nation's climate monitoring agency says January's global land and sea surface temperatures combined were the fourth warmest on record for that month. It's due to a combination of a couple of things, but a lot of it has to do with El Nino. We're working on the averages, of course. So if you take an average of the Januaries of the 20th century, quote, we're working on a 30-plus consecutive Januaries that it's been warmer than the 20th century average, you know, overall. So this January is amongst the warmest Januaries. They have not really had a cold January, or that is to say, a January colder than the 20th century average since the 1970s. Does that mean global warming? Well, you know, for the one gentleman who wrote to me from Florida talking about how cold it's been there, I suggest you consider the potential tornado activity that tends to recur in Florida during those active El Nino years and prepare. Meanwhile, on the West Coast, Dane sent me a link to this story. It wasn't sunbathing weather, writes somebody at the Seattle Times, but January was the warmest on record for the Seattle area. That, according to the National Weather Service, the average temperature was 47 degrees above the average of 45.8 degrees and the highest temperature since they began recording at the Seattle Federal Building in 1891. So I don't know what this proves when you're one way or another for sure, but anybody in the snowboat will tell you that cold weather alone doesn't bury you in snow. It has to be a mix of cold air and warm, moist air that brings on the big snowstorms. And to what degree global warming is or isn't happening, huge amounts of snow is not evidence of its errancy. I look forward to hearing what the February temp averages have been. Anecdotally, in the upper Midwest, it's been a very balmy February. Meanwhile, in Connecticut, all the activity in the skies is not linking to the snowy forecasts. From my Facebook page, Pat writes, on August 27th, 2009, my house began to shake, windows rattled, and there was a terrible loud noise outside. I ran out to see what was going on, and I saw a jet fighter, which was so slow I could not believe my eyes. It was maybe 100 to 200 feet above the trees, and then at a great speed, curved up, disappearing through the clouds. I counted three of these jet fighters. It made a few alarms start going off in the neighborhood. One local paper reported it. He also sent me a link to a story at a TV station, WTNH, that reported it. And he said, now this is where it gets interesting. Now that the low flyover of those fighter jets was August 27th, 2009. He said on Friday, September 11th, 2009, I was driving southbound in Wallingford, Connecticut, and I had someone with me in the car, and there was a huge tractor trailer truck in front of us with an open back. It had a makeshift wooden frame and this huge circular metal object tilted almost on its side. I think it was chained down, which absolutely fit the description of sort of a classic UFO. I couldn't get close enough to the truck to read where it was from or the name of the company, but he said the object was about 25 to 30 feet in diameter, maybe 5 to 6 feet high. I didn't see any seams. Could this be a UFO? And he sent it to the UFO casebook. Anyway, I'll put both of those links up on my blog. You can find that at coasttocoastam.com. And who knows? Maybe in just a couple of months, that unidentified flying object overhead will be me. Did you see the story on the webpage? It finally looks like my jetpack is ready. Just in time for my 50th birthday on Wednesday. Only about, 35 years too late. Martin Aircraft Company in Christchurch, New Zealand, aims to make 500 jetpacks a year, which will sell around 50,000 pounds. What is that now in the exchange rate? Like $70,000, roughly? A 200-horsepower dual-propeller pack, the brainchild of inventor Glenn Martin, who unveiled his machine for the first time in July last year. Go take a look at it on our webpage. It weighs less than 254 pounds. The jetpack does not require a pilot's license. It is capable of traveling 30 miles in 30 minutes on a full tank of fuel. Cool. The recent tests have seen the newest model reach heights of up to 2,400 meters, top speeds of 60 miles per hour. But only now has sufficient investment been found for the company to begin production of the craft, which will also begin at an undisclosed location outside of New Zealand. And because it weighs less than 250 pounds, it does not require a pilot's license. Yes, that is very, very cool. They say that this would be perfect for emergency services, private users, and even in the military. He said this could be life-saving stuff. Yep, you're right. Life-saving, because by the time I get mine, I'll be finished working out and ready to launch my second career as a superhero. Details coming as I start working on my costume. But now you know the entrance I'll be making. And very cool story. Find out more at coasttocoastam.com. And I think we're overdue a revisit to some of the authors who've been working on those jetpack books over the years. Go online, too, and see George Norrie on Nightline last night. You can link up to that at Coast to Coast. And also, while you're there, find out more about our guest coming up next hour. First, Mark Lerner is with us. We know Mark from, well, I'm getting a lot of slap back. We know Mark, of course, from his, all of the contributions he's made over the years on Coast to Coast, especially on these big prediction days. And as I understand it, Mark, you have an insight into the earthquake that happened yesterday in Chile. I haven't heard all the details. So tell me, how do you interconnect with this tragic story that could have been worse? But still, nonetheless, still an 8.8 earthquake last time I heard. Mark?
Yeah, yes. Hi, Ian. And what's happening is that when this occurred exactly, the planet Saturn happened to be over the Earth in that part of the world, around Concepcion, Chile, and that whole vicinity. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can, but why is that significant?
Because the first book I ever read on astrology 38-plus years ago, the reason I got into this whole field was a very unique book, and one of the things that got me really excited was the person's analysis of major planets causing earthquakes, particularly planets like Saturn or Jupiter, Neptune, Uranus. If they're over the Earth, in that location, under the Earth, those kinds of things. Now, there's much more involved than just that, but the Haiti quake, for instance, on January 12th, at the exact time that hit, Saturn was under the Earth, and Saturn had just made, from the Earth's point of view, what's called a station, which only happens twice a year on two individual days when a planet appears to be motionless when it's shifting from direct to retrograde or retrograde to direct. So the Haiti quake, which has unfortunately killed like about 250,000 people because of where it hit right in Port-au-Prince, Saturn, a traditional planet that has a lot to do with destruction and fear, and literally in the old days, if you go back before the discovery of the outer planet, Saturn was the key ruler of death and all kinds of miserable things. We know it's not all negative, but that's the way the ancients sort of looked at it. And so Saturn has been the primary up or down influence for both of these quakes. And at this one, it was almost precisely overhead. There's a lot more to this, Ian, that's astronomical. For instance, there is the largest black hole, real black hole, far out, millions of light years away, in the early in the sign of Libra. And it's the largest, I mean, it's so enormous, it dwarfs anything we could ever think of in terms of our sun, the solar system, even our galaxy. It's just so tremendously big. And that's exactly where this planet Saturn in our solar system is lined up, right with this black hole. That was overhead at this 8.8 earthquake.
Okay. Now, and I'm getting a little slap back in my headphones, so I'm just trying to make sure that I can hear you without having to hear myself twice. It's an earthquake. It could be related to that. Can I ask you a question that came up last night? I know it's not right in your wheelhouse, but so many people commented on it. And I just love, not necessarily from an astrological perspective, but we get so many people that say that, you know, that everything about our planet knows when an earthquake is coming, except us. That, you know, that animals have indicators, something that's about to happen. Birds fly in different directions. Some people even linking the whale attack that happened in SeaWorld to an earthquake. Do you have any perspective on that at all?
That was, I have four things I wanted to make sure I got out here. That was my fourth point. And I thought of that immediately upon this thing. And here's why. It wasn't like, with what happened on Wednesday from the astrology viewpoint in SeaWorld, the moon was in Cancer. The moon had just gone into its own water sign. Now, aside from that, we are on the verge of having, in just a few hours, the first Sun-Jupiter union in 12 years in the last water sign, which is Pisces. And about 60 hours ago, the Sun and Jupiter, the two largest by far, celestial bodies in our solar system, they made what was called a parallel, which is kind of like a zodiacal union, but instead a parallel in astrology is when two celestial bodies are north or south of the celestial equator rather than the zodiacal path that we follow. But the point is this. What happened, and this was interesting on Wednesday afternoon when everybody was so horrified about the killer whale doing it. That wasn't the only thing that happened at SeaWorld. The other whales, I heard this directly on the radio, were not obeying commands, apparently, or at least not all of them were doing what they were supposed to be doing in other events that morning. And there were three alignments that day that all suggested, like in rapid order, very close to the time of the actual event, problems in communication, problems with literally like problem solving itself, and a lot of volatility. And so it was definitely, shall we say, unfortunately, a negative series of vibrations. So I definitely will align myself with those people. I think those whales were picking up ahead of time. And not only that, there's going to be a total solar eclipse, okay, later this year in July, on July 11th. And I've tracked the path of it, okay, astrologically and through astronomy. And we know that Easter Island gets hit by that. It's going to be a very rare alignment in the South Pacific Ocean. And it goes through Easter Island. And guess where it ends? In southern Chile. This is the only total solar eclipse of the whole year. And it's contacting southern Chile. And if you backtrack, if you compare what will happen in July, and you look at the astrology of that chart for the eclipse, and you look at the astrology of what just happened, you can see the links between the events. In many ways, Ian, we have both the past and the future. What was happening on Wednesday in SeaWorld was like a mini sort of gearing up, and it became an enormously big story for so many people, but we didn't know it was necessarily going to be kind of a tip-off that another part of the world was going to be affected like this.
Mark, this is what I'm asking you to do. Will you shoot me an email when we get closer to July and remind me of this conversation? You may be on in between then, but just to make sure. And so we'll keep an eye on this Easter Island eclipse. We take from this conversation that we should look out for full moons as being windows for earthquakes, and that, as you say there, the astronomical alignment could have an indication too of what might be happening. And so we'll ask you to sort of prep us for a potential major event coming up sometime in July. Does that sound good, Mark?
Oh, yeah, that sounds like it could be very important, because Chile could be affected, but the whole South Pacific and other areas around the planet as well.
Very good. Thank you, Mark. I look forward to finishing this conversation then sometime later on this spring into the summer. Keep that in mind, and that may or may not be someplace you want to go coming up when we do open lines next for just a half hour, and then we'll be taking you back to a dark period in our history where serial killers were getting away left and right with the most awful deeds, which are accounted for in the Poisoner's Handbook, and how it's affecting us today on Coast to Coast. Well, we'll grab a bunch of you all live here coming up in just a few minutes. Looking forward to this, taking it to the top of the hour. Coming up tomorrow, George Knapp was having technical difficulties, as I understand it, and so I am stepping in. We're going to follow up on a couple of things tomorrow night, the first being the last of the many questions to be answered around Columbine. It came out in an article on Friday. We've got the author of the piece, who also is has been a guest here on Coast to Coast, a guy I went to college with, a guy named Dave Cullen, who wrote the definitive work on Columbine called Columbine. And it's an intriguing development. And he has exclusive access to the answer to one of these questions that have haunted many people from Columbine. And we'll find out whether there's any more left to be answered in just a quick first hour interview coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. And then we'll get into Native American Bigfoot legends, or as many people would like to say, the Native American Bigfoot insights. We'll talk about some of the latest sightings, too, coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. But first, where are you going to take us? We'll find out next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So let's start with whoever's been waiting on the longest as we do open lines before the Poisoner's Handbook coming up at the top of the hour. James is in New Mexico on a first-time caller line on Coast to Coast. James?
I want to thank you, first of all, for your time. I really appreciate it. I was curious, Paul, listen, on Thursday, I heard that this aircraft was seen flying over the San Diego Mountains, and it went towards Edgewood, and it knocked out the power. What I'm curious about is that it was never discussed after it happened. Nobody really brought it up, the subject up again. I'm just wondering if any other callers or did you hear about it yourself?
No, I didn't. I didn't hear about it, and that's interesting. What's the buzz around where you are?
Well, here's what happened. Okay, I don't know if you're familiar with the Sandia Crest. There are multiple towers that are lit up, so to speak, with production lights. And what happened was a certain section of town lost power, and then the Sandia Crest lost power, and people were reporting that they were seeing this triangular airplane of some type or whatever flying over Edgewood, which is on the east side of the mountains. And now, when that was reported on the radio, nobody seemed to call afterwards. And I was just curious as to why, people didn't call in about that. I would just assume that, if somebody saw a vehicle or an airplane or some type of form of aircraft, more would be discussed about it. And what was interesting to me is that pretty much, there was no discussion about that afterwards. And that makes it really curious to me,
Well, yeah, I mean, sometimes you can't answer for why something doesn't happen because you don't know why it didn't happen. But it's helpful to hear from other people out there and what they did hear. So I'd love to hear more about it if people can respond to James' question in the time that we have between now and the top of the hour. Brooke has been waiting in Newport, Rhode Island on Coast to Coast. Brooke?
Thank you, Ian, for taking my call. I'm calling about a very disturbing observation, and this may be in relation to the smiley face killer. I have noticed in reading the Boston papers since about November that there have been four young men who have been found in the water off Boston in the last few months. The first was a young man whose body was found in the Charles River in November. The second was a young man whose body was found in the Fort Point Channel off Boston Harbor. The third was a young man, 16 years old, whose body was found off Gloucester Harbor. And the latest, just this last week, was a young man, 25 years old, a University of Massachusetts graduate from Amherst, and a very responsible Raytheon electrical engineer who was reported missing last Saturday night after partying at Faneuil Hall. Now, I haven't noticed anything about a smiley face placed anywhere around where these bodies are found, but all these young men seem to fit the profile of your journalist guest, Christy Peel, in listening to her interview several weeks ago, and I was wondering if you could pass this information along to her, because you know Boston is a major college town.
Oh, it sure is. In fact, I was just there and just at Faneuil Hall not long ago. I'll pass one thing on to you that she said the last time she was on, which was that she has been de-emphasizing the smiley face iconography that has been associated with this series of disappearances. In many cases, these misdiagnosed, I guess would be the word, the errantly concluded autopsies that she has been looking at, that in many of the most famous cases, there was nothing associated with it in the form of a smiley face graffiti icon. And she said that she was having her suspicions that perhaps one of the investigators, that not in her presence, but people with whom she'd been associated, might have been putting the smiley face at some of the scenes of some of these supposed crimes, to help connect them together. Now, she said that the last time she was on the air with us. And that's all I know on that. So I will definitely mention it to her. So the fact that there hasn't been anything found doesn't mean that it isn't connected. The other connection that had happened in the case of the ones that she was following was that they all tended to fall very closely to the I-94 corridor across the northern United States. And so geographically, I'm not sure how this relates, but certainly it does in terms of some of the other details of these disappearances. Sam is in Phoenix on Coast to Coast Open Line. Sam?
Hello?
Hi.
Yeah, hi, thank you. Hey, I wanted to talk to you about, George Norrie had a program on the other night with two authors on the Witnesses to Roswell.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The Witnesses to Roswell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I lived in New Mexico for about 25 years of my life. And while I was there, I was reading, I think it was Bill Cooper, and he mentioned in his book that there's a live ET that was captured, and they mentioned that in the program the other night. And I think Bill Cooper was suggesting it was at Los Alamos Laboratories is where they kept it. And it just so happened that my banker that I had there in New Mexico was raised in Los Alamos all his life. His father was in security there. And when he was going up through the ranks there, he'd get summer jobs during his high school and his college. And he had the highest security clearance you could get in Los Alamos Labs. And I was telling him this story, and he all of a sudden he jerked up and he snapped his fingers. He went and shut his door, his office door. And he says, "That's what was in that compound." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "There was a compound there in Los Alamos, and it was like 30 by 30 feet or 40 by 40 feet. And it was, the fence were like 13 feet tall, and they had barbed wire on them, and they had laser beams up on top so nobody could get in or out. And one door, no windows." And he said, "That's what was in that compound." I wondered why I couldn't go in there. And so that's why I couldn't go in there. But at any rate, what I thought would be a good thing to do is see if we get a hold of those authors and let them follow up on this story.
Okay.
And see,
All right, I can pass it along to the producer for George and see if he can get that to the authors, just because I don't have that information handy and I didn't catch that show. But I can do that. I can let Tom know. And if you want to hang on, Sam, you can give the number to Gina, who's screening the calls. And if Gina wants to grab your number and then pass it along to Tom to track down that banker, that might be very helpful, too. Tim is in Los Angeles on a wild card line. On Coast to Coast. Tim?
Hey, thanks, Ian. Thanks a lot. You know what's really cool about epiphanies? I mean, people come up with I guess, ideas that's been conflicting, you know, people for a long time. For example, this epiphany I had was about climate change. And you know how people go back and forth. Climate change is man-made. Climate change is nature, back and forth. Mm-hmm. Well, I had an epiphany while brushing my teeth about climate change, and I was thinking, climate change may be man-made, and the evidence that the epiphany that I had was HAARP and chemtrails can also create, you know, affect the climate, and it is man-made. So that was my epiphany.
And you're saying that you think that HAARP or chemtrails are changing the environment, and so that would explain why the temperatures are going up.
Up and down, because I think it was on Alex Jones's website. They said that they're spraying chemtrails in order to keep the Earth cool.
Wait.
Yeah.
We're talking about global warming.
Right. So because if global warming is a natural occurrence, and then in order to block the sunlight out or the radiation, what happens is that...
So you're saying that they would do this to try to combat global warming.
Right.
Okay, so global warming wouldn't be caused by that.
But at the same time, it's affecting our climate. Or, okay. You know how they would also use HAARP to move, like, you know, hurricanes around. But what we're using with HAARP may ultimately affect our climate and, you know, make our Earth unbalanced.
All right, well, I will. This is true for all, by the way, of the Northern Hemisphere. We're talking about a pretty, when we talk global warming, I don't know that we have the resources to be able to affect the global temperature, but the subject about global cooling is interesting in that we've already talked to some people who say that we might have to take steps eventually to combat global warming by trying to create some global cooling. And there have been a lot of people who say, and I wasn't the first, although I am proud to say that I was making a connection a long time ago on this. And if you look at the trends of our cleaner air, of getting the, you know, a lot of the pollution elements out of our air starting in the 1970s, we started to warm up. And that the pollution that was in the air was actually keeping our temperatures more stable and sort of more traditional. And that maybe that's a problem. As we continue to clean up our environment, we're continuing to maybe turn things against us even more. Maybe we have to go back to polluting for a little while just to balance things out. I know that sounds crazy, but I'm not the only one now who's uttered such a heresy. Randy is in Pasadena on Coast to Coast on an open line. Hey, Randy, we're just taking this to the top of the hour.
Okay. Hi, Ian. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you. Where do you want to take us?
Yeah, the gentleman that called earlier about the, the signs of animals giving prediction to natural disasters.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in Mount St. Helens back in 1981. Remember St. Helens?
Sure, that would have been a blue, yeah.
Yeah, I was camping down on Tula River, which is like 19 miles. We're about 5 miles due north by northwest, and all of a sudden, you know, all the sounds of being outside, the birds and the water. We were right by. Right there on the Tula River, and everything got really, really, really quiet, just like you can hear a pin drop. And all of a sudden, the fish in the river started jumping straight out of the water. Like it would have been a fisherman's dream come true if they saw something like that. And all of a sudden, we heard like a sonic boom, and then a second one, another sonic boom. And we thought, wow, you know, that we thought they were just blasting dynamite. The logging companies did for landings and whatnot.
Right.
And the guy that took us down to the camping spot, about, 20 minutes later, he came down, was all crazy. He said, started tearing our tent down. So we got to get out of here. The mountain just blew up. And we said, get out of here. The mountain didn't blow up. But it did.
But you witnessed it firsthand with the animals and the birds and everybody going crazy like that. Yeah.
It was weird. It was like it got really, really quiet. There was no sound. And then all of a sudden the fish started shooting straight out of the water. And then the explosion happened about a couple seconds after the fish started shooting up out of the water.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And that's the kind of agitation that we've heard about and people connecting to yesterday's earthquake. And, of course, you remember, too, there was an earthquake earlier in the week in Japan off the coast of Okinawa. So, you know, it's been a busy week for the Pacific Rim, and there might be some more activity still coming up. We think about, like, you know, what did I hear, like 2 or 3 dozen aftershocks in Chile, and that can be triggering something else, too, that we've just yet to hear about. Marlo is in California on this new Skype line. Marlo, how's the sound on the Skype line?
Oh, I love it right now. How is it over there?
Oh, good. Well, you're a little hollow, but we'll take it anyway. Open line. Go ahead. We got a minute for you.
Yes, I was telling the caller that basically I just bought one of those new fancy smartphones.
Right.
It has a Google Sky Map, which is like a night view, so you can see all the stars and celestials and everything.
Yep.
And last night I was talking to my friend outside and showing him what I was how to work with it. And I noticed that there were 6 planets. Like in tonight, there's 5 of them lined up in a straight row. I could see Uranus, Venus, Jupiter, Neptune, and Mercury. And when I was playing with it last night, the moon was in one direction, and these other planets were in a straight line, but in the opposite direction. So when I was showing him as I was turning around, I noticed that the moon was in basically like a planar direction. And this was about 6 hours before the earthquake happened. Do you think anything like that might have had some trigger off?
Boy, that is so over my head, Marlo, but that's an interesting thought. Other people that know more might be able to jump in between now and when we close off open lines here in a second, but or maybe sometime in the future we can get back to that. Barbara is in Connecticut. First-time caller line, probably going to be the last one we get to before the Poisoner's Handbook. Barbara?
Yes, Ian, I appreciate your taking my call. I enjoyed your program, and last night you were extremely sensitive with the grief that Nick Meyer had and with Chekhov, with his son.
Walter
and
Koenig, yeah.
I really appreciate your sensitivity. But what I did call for was, I was wondering with the earthquake, if it had anything to do with, you were talking about the huge ice breaking off, ice breaking off at the Antarctic.
There was a calving of a major iceberg, they said roughly the size of Oahu or the country of Luxembourg in Europe, and it came at a part of Antarctica that doesn't ordinarily see that type of calving, right?
Uh-huh. And I was wondering if the earthquake or if it was prior to the earthquake or if some of that had something to do with.
Well, that's a really good question. That's entirely possible. Again, a better question than I have an answer. Could it have possibly been that early tremors sent enough of a nudge to that earthquake? I mean, enough to that particular ice shelf that was hanging off of that ridge on the cooler side of Antarctica, that it might have just been just the straw on that needed to break it off, or something the other way around. Maybe that breaking off was an indicator that there was an earthquake coming, and that whether it was tell you what, and I'm not going to be able to solve it in the next 20 seconds, but maybe some other people will know. You can link up to me if you want to on my Facebook page, or we'll get to another round of open lines soon, I'm sure. In the meantime, you got to hang on for the Poisoner's Handbook. It's Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine. CSI started because of the number of serial killers that were on the loose, poisoning people with impunity during the Jazz Age in New York. And not just in New York, obviously, but that's where the book is focused. But we'll talk about this coming up on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.